Steve Tinkle, you are from the Harlan, Iowa area, and you have put together a collection of some of the most unusual products that came out of the formative era of hybrid corn development. First of all, why did you decide that this was an area you wanted to pursue?
Thanks, Ken. It all started out, Shelby County, where I live, through just an accident, I found out and documented there were 18 seed corn companies that started here in Shelby County, really mom-and-pop companies. And the reason they started here from my research is, one, you live in the number one corn-producing state in the nation. Shelby County has always been in the top 10, if not the top one, with Kossuth County in corn production all the way back to the 1850s. And so if you were going to start a business, you're going to want to have it be in a county or a state where you can brag a little bit and promote where you're going to get your top yields. And then I think another reason Shelby County was at the top is we had very ambitious and We had very ambitious and producers that were willing to push the envelope. And this was a hard-working business, and they had the families there to support that. So I think when you put all that together, this was a prime spot for it.
Now, you have a collection that you have shown off in your own museum, and I'd like, first of all, if you wouldn't mind, to just do an answer to this. Have you attempted to bring that museum to the public in a manner that gave it more exposure for people for today, and how successful were you at gaining that broader attention?
Sure. Yeah, I started my collection here at my museum. Oh, it's been about 15 years ago, and every other year, I'd have it open to the public in the summer months from June to September. And then every other year, I would hold a corn expo here. My last corn expo was 2 years ago. I had people here from 17 states. And really what started out as just a little show to people locally had way outgrown me. And it's something that took me almost a year to prepare for every year. Without the help of my family, it wouldn't happen. And so I'm getting up in age, and I lost my wife 5 years ago, and I promised my children that before I retired from my paying job working for the city of Harlan, I'm a water treatment superintendent, that I would find a home for this because it's just too much for any family to try to dispose of. And so I actually reached out to Iowa State University. I reached out to the Iowa State Fair. I worked with Governor Branstad. He'd been at my farm at the state level trying to find a permanent home for my entire collection. I didn't get any takers. It wasn't that everybody said no right away, but after they looked at it and looked at a place to house this and a place that people could enjoyed and actually walk around everything, it was going to take a multi-million-dollar building. And I was a little disappointed nobody was willing to take that on. So I, 5 years ago, and seven other county leaders in my county decided we were going to try to do this and incorporate it with a learning center. We worked every third, we got together every other Thursday for 5 years. And looked at building a multi-million-dollar building. And really, we were really close of finding the money to build the building, but the biggest obstacle, and if you look at museums around the country, a few years after they get going, it's really hard to keep the doors open. The annual operating expense is what takes them down. And so I tried. It was, like I said, with some leaders here, and we just couldn't pull it off. And so I'm getting close to retirement here in a couple of years, and now it's just the time, I feel, that I need to start parting this out, and hopefully it'll go into the hands of some other museums and collectors, and my family doesn't have to worry about what they're going to do with it.
Do you, this is off the wall, but do you have a dollar figure of what you've appraised that collection to be worth?
No. I have tried. I've talked to a couple of appraisers. excuse me. The first thing they say is, can you give us some examples of some of the similar things, what they brought? I have quite a few things in my museum that are one of a kind. Everything in my museum, everything has been restored back to its original condition and working condition. That's what separates my museum apart from a lot of them. And so to go back to answer your question, no, I don't have an appraised value. People are afraid to do that. So I really don't have a value. Actually, when I insured things, I could only insure it for what I paid for it unless I could show an example where one similar was sold.
So we can say priceless, but yet you're about to put a price on it, or basically give the public the chance to price it one item at a time. Steve, could you step into your museum and just walk through, if you would, highlighting the things that you have perhaps in groups to be able to tell us a little bit about what is going to be in this two-day auction that you're having in the near future?
Okay, I'll start first with the thing that started all this was I started collecting the cloth acorn sacks, and I was only going to do it for Shelby County, and what started out trying to find really just a half a dozen sacks turned into, I found 36 sacks from just Shelby County alone. I have all that on display. They are not going to be on the auction. I'm keeping that back to find a permanent home, whether in the county or the state for that. That's not leaving. But the sacks are really what started all this. And there's going to be about 150 sacks on the museum, some of them one of a kind, some of them very local mom-and-pop sacks. I have about 250 Seacorn signs and plate toppers. There's these little license plates back in the day that went on top of the license plates of all the different Seacorn companies. The Seacorn sacks, especially the signs, are very, very hot collectible items. From there, some of the one-of-a-kind items I have a Rumley, they call it Brush Buster Plow, just a one bottom, that was only made from 1907 to 1911, made by the Rumley Steam Engine Company. And I took it actually to their national show up at Albert City, Iowa, 5-6 years ago. And the club members said they've only seen pictures of it, and it's only one they know that it survived the Iron Man. I have one of my oldest items in my museum is I have an 1845. It's called Cannon Sheller. It's where you backed your wagon of beer corn, which would have been open pollinated corn, back up to the back of the sheller. And it's a cast iron cylinder sheller, one of the first of its kind. It was made up in Pottstown, Pennsylvania. It would shell the corn. You'd use a steam engine or a hydraulic motor with a belt pulley to operate it. It would shell the corn. It would grade the corn. It would separate the foreign material from it. It would take the tobs out the front of the sheller, and then it had two bags that were fastened to a wooden elevator, and then that's where you would bag your seed for open pollinated, because up until the 1930s, from the 1850s to the 1930s when hybrid corn came out, that's what people did. They saved their corn they picked in the fall. They'd save some of the bigger ears. They would dry it, and then they would do something like this to shell it. I know the farm collector did a story on this sheller a few years back, and I've never heard of anybody in the collectors that collect the shellers have never seen another one like it, and it's sitting in my museum, ready to be used. I have around 50 hand corn planters. They were, after they started with the hoe in the mid-1800s. Are you still there?
Yes, I am. Yeah, it's sounding good.
Okay. Okay. We have the hand planters. That's what started after they used the hoe. I have over 50 different kinds of hand planters. And I actually have a two-row hand planter that was made between 1850 and 1867 back in the Abraham Lincoln era, where you'd actually use that, carry throughout the field. I can't imagine what that would have been like. I have cast iron seats. I have a large collection of corn dryers, which is you would put the ear corn that you would save for or seed for the next year. You would fasten these on these dryers, hang them up in your attic or up in your storage shed, and then in the wintertime after they got dried, you'd shell the corn. I have over 30 box shellers, all different makes. They're in that 1920 to 1950 vintage. I also have one of the first, it's called a straddle sheller. It's 1845. I have two different versions of that. It's called a Briggs sheller. I have a family corn sheller, 1868. What you're going to find in my museum is, I'm going to say, a lot of the equipment, a majority of the equipment, is pre-1900. So it's even before the hybrid corn. I have a collection of row markers, which is the old drop planters. They had wooden and cast iron and steel, different types of markers out at the end of the planter. Very collectible. Probably the thing that touches my passion the most, that I've had the most fun doing, is I have what I've been told the largest collection in the United States of wooden drop planters that are in a range from the 1850s to the 1880s. They're wooden, they're two-man planters. You had to have, one person would run the planter, the horse, would operate the horse that pulled the planter, and one person would sit on the seat and drop the seed where it needed to be. They used to hill drop every 40 to 44 inches, depends on the width of your planter. They would drop three seeds per hill, and that happened between the 1850s and 1870s. Then check wire came out, and that was from the 1870s to the 1950s. People used check wire to drop their seed, and that really revolutionized the corn planting industry for a couple of reasons. One, it eliminated that person on the planter, the second person, so you eliminated half the labor of dropping the seed, a lot more accuracy. And then you also did not have to go out the day before and use a row marking sled, a field marker, to mark your field. I have one of them. It's the only original one that I have seen. I got it actually south of Chicago on a sale. It has three runners on it. The runners are as wide as the corn planter you would be using. And the day before, you would need to go out with a and pull the sled north and south, and when you turn around, you put one of the runners back in one of the lines you just made. And then when you got done doing that in the whole field, then you'd have to parallel and do the same thing east and west. And so when you got done, you'd have a 40 or 44 inch square. And then you could go out the next day, hope it didn't rain or the wind blew a lot, and you could start planting. So you eliminated that when the check wire came out. And when I would have my stroke, I would plant a 1 acre, I called my 3-century corn plot. I would plant corn of the first hybrid, or the first open pollinated corn, which was Reed Joe's dad.
You're breaking up a little bit on me, Steve. I need to walk back outside.
Okay.
Let's go back.
Yeah, when I,
you,
let me start you again where you just finished up saying that you made the square.
Okay. Yep. You made the square, and then you would go out the next day with the planner, and then when you get to the cross sections, wherever there was an X, that person would drop the seed. Well, when the check wire was invented and came out, the check wire planners around the 1870s, that eliminated 50% of the labor to get the corn planted because you eliminated the person operating the dropper. You eliminated one day ahead of operating the row marking sled. And when I check planted before my expo every other year, I did an acre and I called it my 3-century corn plot. And what I would do is I would plant some of the first open pollinated corn, which for our area was Reed Yellow Dent, the first commercially sold hybrid that came out, which was called US 13, and then some of the triple stack corn I plant out in my fields today. And when I did that, it was amazing, one, just how the hybrid technology has changed. But two, those people using the check wire, I mean, if you were really good at it, and I was not at first, but as you learn the tricks of the trade, you could plant that seed within an inch of where you wanted to be planting it, using that check wire spread a quarter mile across the field. Today, we call that GPS. And so they were not didn't have the technology. We don't give them enough credit for the ingenuity and the technology that they had and what they had to use.
Steve, are you going to sell the contents of your brain? And how are you going to go about transferring it?
Well, I have transferred some of it. I had a person, a writer from the Wallace's Farmer was out to one of my shows probably 10 years ago. And she called me back about 6 months later, and she said, Steve, you need to write a book. And I laughed. And she says, no. She said, I did some research. She says, you are the only corn museum that's open to the public out there in the country. And I said, that's sad. I said, it's on my 5-generation century farm. But Time Magazine in 1992 listed mankind's greatest inventions of the last 1,000 years right before the millennium. And the invention of hybrid corn was right up there with the invention of electricity and the airplane. And yet, that one statement is what changed my life. Because I lived it with my grandparents and great-grandparents, and I did not realize the impact it had on American agriculture. And so, I don't want the future generations to forget why we have it so good today. And so I did end up writing a book, and it's called Kernels of Corn History. I released it in 2013. It's about my museum. It's about my one-of-a-kind museum. It's about Shelby County and how it played a major role in Iowa and the implements that we started with prior to the invention of hybrid corn. And I hope to, when I retire here and don't have the museum to care for, I hope to hit the road a little bit. I've been offered to go out and do some speaking on this subject. I went to Philadelphia 3 years ago in November and spoke to the Net Impact Conference, about 3,200 college kids, about how the invention of hybrid corn revolutionized American agriculture, and it was very accepted. I've had comments and questions and everything since then. So, yeah, I still plan to spread some of that knowledge.
Steve, let's finish up here by the talking about people getting a sale bill. First of all, I understand the dates of your sale are going to be Friday, September 13th at 1 o'clock. And then you'll start again on Saturday morning at 9 o'clock. So the 13th, 14th, a two-day sale.
Correct.
How can people get a copy of this sale bill electronically?
Okay. If you go to CHUPP, C-H-U-P-P, Auctions and Real Estate, they're out of CHUPP 20, Indiana. The sale bill is listed on there if you go to auctionzip.com. Also, you can go to my local auctioneer here in the county is also helping with the sales. It's osborneauction.com. Either one, you'll get the sale bill. There's like 470-some pictures of different implements. And just really most of the things that were going to be on the sale. So that's the best way, place to go.
Wow. Boy, you do that well. Oh, my God. Well, I'm sorry you're having to sell this.
Yeah, me too. I really was hoping we could have got that Discovery Center south of Harlan. And then I was hoping that was going to be my retirement project because then the people that are calling wanted me to come speak. They could actually come out here and I could have taken them to any farm they wanted to go to, whether it was cattle, dairy, hogs, you know, that's where Joel was.
Well, I served on the board of two ag museums, Living History Farms in Des Moines and the Agriculture Hall of Fame in Kansas City. And you are exactly right. It's operating expenses that eat their lunch. And even though with both of them, they're sitting there with millions of dollars worth of land, they can't sell it because if they do, they ruin the whole experience, and they struggle in an environment you'd think they wouldn't. But it all comes down to entertainment dollars. And both of them made their money on school kids coming out on field days.
Yep, and that's what I was going to say. What I have learned through this process is that museums, I don't care what kind of museum it is, if they want to survive, they have to be not a standalone venue. They have to be surrounded by education. They have to be incorporated. That's why the governor, even Tim Reynolds, who liked our idea, if we could have pulled that off where we had 12 school districts in a 50-mile radius that kids would come, and we would have, what we did was reached out to the agribusinesses. That's what we started with, but we also had plumbers and bricklayers and all that, too. People needed skilled jobs. So we took the inventory of what the skilled jobs were going to be, okay? Then these businesses would help donate to the museum, or we call it Discovery Center. The 12 school districts around us, so those juniors and seniors would come, learn that trade, whether it's for 1 year or two, get a certificate when they come out. The only catch is they had to go work for that business in our area in a 50-mile radius for 1 year. And come out no college debt because it was going to be paid for by the school and the business. My collection was there just as an educational tool and had decor to the building and learn from that. But to me, that's the only way these museums are going to survive, using as an educational tool.
Did you know Linus Moore, who was the guy who operated Old Freshers Reunion over in Mount Pleasant?
No.
He had...
I go up there every year, but I don't know. That is known.
I got to talk to him a few times back in the AgriTalk era, and he had a great line. He said, look at all this machinery we've got here. He said the oldest person here was a child the last time this stuff ran.
Oh, yeah.
And he said it's so hard to translate this into an understanding of today. And he said that's why we operate everything that's here. And so people would come in, and you had to drive your tractor. You had to run your thresher. You had to do the sawmill, everything. He said if it comes in here, we only have a few items that simply won't work but have historical value that can be static. Everything else has to run.
Yep. And I think, Ken, that's the reason my museum has been so welcome and accepted is because the things I hear from people that leave is one of the things. A lot of the equipment, I don't know if you want me to record this, but a lot of my equipment has signage on it. It says the year it was either produced or patented, what it is, where it came from, and some of it I have some sayings on what they actually use it for. By the way, because all these people don't know what it is. Like I said, and everything's in working condition. But one of the things I wanted to touch on that I didn't before is, to me, one of the most valuable things I have in my museum is the drop planners. I have 9 of them, and they're...
You're breaking up on me. Go start the drop planters again.
The drop planters are in 1860 to 1880 vintage. They're all different. They're all originally restored, working condition. I'm told I have the largest collection out there. Even Chuck Dawson said we've never seen more than 2 at any one place, and we rarely see them in the museums. Those things fascinated me, and how we were able to go from that to what we are today. And I get a little disappointed in times when I'm trying to find a home for this, and, you know, the people don't take an interest because once this is gone, it's our heritage. You know, I just...
Sure.
There's
I'm going to run this. I'm going to post it on our website, iowaagnet.com, with the full interview. I'll drop into there, and then also I'll do probably 2 stories on this, starting one now, and maybe doing one in the near future after that, and try to make it to where people are aware of this enough ahead. I'll probably do my last story before the 1st of September. I wish that, you know, somebody like Pioneer would see the value of this, and but they're screwed up now on everything that they can. And Syngenta, you wrote it in your story to me that they pulled the plug.
We're so close.
Yeah. And
we probably would have got the Discovery Center if the tariffs don't come on. I don't want to go publicly and say that.
No. Yeah, I understand that. And you can't say for sure.
We're so close.
But, you know, people at those companies, you know, there's an old line at John Deere that they wish they had never said. They said, we don't make old tractors. In other words, this is the 1980s line. We want nothing to do with all this stuff. And as a result of that, they had the people that kind of took offense at it. And then, of course, the collectors became those people, you know, who valued this more than the company itself. But the company has to look at day-to-day and profitability for tomorrow, stockholders, et cetera. So they just have a very hard time justifying this. And one person who doesn't have any kind of a heart, I guess, can line through an expenditure for this, and it's over. So that's just the way it is.
It took, you know, I was only at this 21 years, but I really had 3 local guys within another 50-mile radius. They were collecting 40, 50 years of piece, and a majority of my equipment came from these guys, and collectors normally don't sell stuff, but when they seen I was restoring it, showing it off to the public, they started, hey, what else do you want, blah, blah, blah. And then they and the public, my museum wouldn't be what it is today without the public's help, because a lot of, the first 5 years, I couldn't find it fast enough, and the last 15, it finds me. And I have people from collectors, to people that know me, call me and say, hey, this is going to be on the sale, this is going to be on the sale. You know, this is a one of a kind. I mean, without people like that, I wouldn't have what I have.
So
it's a community event. Well, off the record, when you were talking about John Deere, I reached out to them and their so-called museum people collected. Yeah, I couldn't get him to come over here. There's this Deere Mansur planner, which was before Deere, this drop planner, needs to be in a museum like that. They have one, it's not restored, but they just said we don't have the room, and I'll get donated.
That's Steve Kankel from Erling, Iowa, who's holding his sale on September 13 in the afternoon and September 14 in the morning on his farm near Erling, Iowa. You can download his sale bill from our website, iowaagnet.com. I'm Ken Root.